Moby Dick Energy. Big Moby Dick Energy.
Thank you for calling Donald J. Trump Election War Room.
All of our agents are busy helping other customers. At the tone, please record your message. When you've finished recording, you may hang up or press the pound key for more options.
Hi, I'm calling from a very contested district in Northeast Philadelphia. And I wanted to report that I was prevented from voting by Antifa. As I got to my polling place, there was an Antifa at the door, dressed all in black. You know, about 6'4", mesmerizing green eyes, sharp cheekbones, just muscled physique. I was very intimidated as a voter. He was standing at the door of my polling line, and as I moved closer, he shifted slightly, and the raw, sensual grace of his movements really awakened something in me that's just sort of been lying dormant for a lot of years in my marriage to my husband, Bob. And the sheer sensual and erotic power of his presence made me want to peel off his threatening mask and black garb and make passionate love. But I couldn't do that at a polling station. I found myself completely overcome by the forces of Eros, which overcame even my desire to vote for our beautiful president, Donald J. Trump. And in lieu of casting my vote for any candidate, I went home and engaged in furious acts of onanism for several days. Only now can I emerge to give my report. This hideous voter intimidation must be stopped. Thank you for saving our country.
I want that Moby Dick. I want that energy. I want that Moby Dick energy. Big Moby Dick energy. I want that MDD. That Moby Dick energy. I want that Moby Dick energy. Big Moby Dick energy.
Three, two, one. Hello and welcome to Moby Dick Energy, the podcast where I, your host, Talia Lavin, goes through Herman Melville's 1851 queer whaling masterpiece, chapter by chapter, with an array of amazing guests. And in this particularly strange week in the world, we are going through chapter 48, The First Lowering, which, true to its title, is the first time we encounter a real-life whale in this book about whales, and the shorter, more humorous chapter 49, The Hyena. And with me, I'm super lucky to have someone I've had a like writer crush on for a really long time, and who I think is brilliant and very talented, the wonderful Lily Loofborough, who is a staff writer at Slate. Hello, Lily.
Hello. Oh my gosh, that was the nicest introduction ever. Hi.
Hi, thank you for being one of the many people I've assaulted in the DMs and just been like, read Moby Dick with me.
I'm delighted. I have not read this book in so long, and I don't remember a ton, but I'm excited to talk about these chapters, and I'm excited to have you explain it to me.
Yeah, well, I think we can kind of explain it to each other as we go, and one of the delights of revisiting the book in this way, it had been a very long time since I read it before I started this podcast, and so I'm kind of perennially rediscovering it along with my guests. We've got these two chapters. Chapter 48, The First Lowering, is like, so just to catch you up on the prior week, we've just seen a whale. We've had a There She Blows for the first time since the Pequod set off, and 48 chapters into the book, a book about whaling, we actually see a whale. But more dramatically, at the beginning, we have five sudden appearances of strangers appearing for the first time at the, like, in the ship. And it's time for a feature that's a perennially recurring on this podcast, which is Melville is really weird about Reese.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, there was a lot of that in this chapter.
A lot of it. Like a surprising amount, because it's like about whaling, and then it's like, how did you have time for this much Orientalism in one chapter about whaling? But yeah, basically, we've had some intimations basically from the start of the book when Ishmael and Queequeg encounter a man literally named Elijah, who prophesies to them that things aren't going to go well.
Look ye, when Captain Ahab is all right, then this left arm of mine will be all right, not the four.
He points out that, like, five men have come aboard the ship in darkness. And a couple of chapters ago, Melville foreshadows this moment when one sort of normal anonymous sailor named Archie, like, hears the sounds of sleepers below.
Hark ye, Kabako!
And, like, a coughing, and basically says there are some secret dudes on the ship.
There is somebody down in the after hold that has not yet been seen on deck, and I suspect our old mogul knows something of it, too.
And it turns out there are some secret dudes on this ship. And basically Ahab has smuggled five Asian men, Aboriginal natives of the Manilas, on board to serve as the staff, the people who come along with him on his whaleboat. And the word swart, which I guess is swarthy, is used like three times in the first three paragraphs.
Like, there's a lot of stuff, yeah. There are turbans.
Yeah, so one of them is wearing a turban, Fidala. He's sort of the head of these guys. And yeah, we talk about tiger yellow complexions, steel-like lips. There's just a lot of objectification going on. And all the sailors are kind of like, what the fuck is happening? Where did these five guys come from? And why are they so swart?
Yeah, and then there's like a weird, like, I was trying to figure out what the last part of that description is signaling, because the metaphors seem to be somewhat, I don't know, espionage and money are the, you know, so it says that they're a race notorious for a certain diabolism of subtlety, and by some honest white mariners supposed to be the paid spies and secret confidential agents on the water of the devil, their lord, whose counting room they supposed to be elsewhere. Do you get the counting room thing?
I guess they're the devil's counting room. I guess they, meaning like, no, okay. I'm going to look this up in my trusty annotation, Power Moby Dick, though it usually just like tells you, oh no, it just explains what a counting room is. I know what a counting room is. I guess, yeah, I mean, what Melville is sort of uncritically giving us here is that white mariners, honest white mariners, are mistrustful of Filipinos and find them devilish and overly subtle.
In Philadelphia and in Pittsburgh, which, by the way, was not going on in most of the rest of the state, where the process was orderly, people were allowed to observe. And when I say most of the rest of the state, that's most of the state that voted in large numbers for Donald J. Trump. Whereas Pennsylvania and Pittsburgh were places where Biden got anywhere from 8 to 6 out of 10 votes. So you can hide an illegal vote or illegal votes very, very, very easily in this situation.
So I don't really know what to make of that, except that I know that Filipino people are like very much a kind of still quite seafaring. Like there are a lot of sailors still from the Philippines. And some of them are probably treated pretty poorly by quote unquote honest white mariners. And I know in the COVID-19 crisis, there's been a lot of trouble with shore leave and people have just been like stuck at sea. A lot of them are Filipino. So,
really?
Yeah. So that's not really, I don't really know how to respond to when Melville is just like openly like just gives in to the racism of the period, which he sometimes manages to rise above. But like, this book is an artifact of its time, and I think that's part of it. It's not an excuse for it. Like, you can definitely write about human beings like human beings, not be all weird, Herman. But
yeah, and you know. I mean, I don't think this is not a defense, but I do think that I think point of view in this chapter is really strange and kind of interesting, and by the end, like, all of the skepticism and fear has dissolved into pure awe. Like, I feel like the narrator's going through a lot of shit in the subsequent chapter. but I don't know if that means that it's a permanent change or if this is just still meant to be a symbol of doom that Elijah correctly read, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's always, dubious when people posit that, like skin color is like a portent of doom.
Yeah, it's not good. Right.
No. It's kind of lazy writing too. So I'm going to throw my literary critic hat on and say that I think that's lazy, Melville. and if I had been your editor, I would have questioned that choice. But we've both benefited and suffered from the seeming abdication of Melville's editors in any way over the course of this book. But yeah, so this is Ishmael's first time. So Ishmael, the main character, has been basically a merchant mariner for much of his career, his whole career. He's been like a sailor on ordinary ships, and this is his first time on a whaling journey. And this is his first time ever going after a whale. And so we see this chapter through his eyes, and he's kind of just frantically observing, like, what the hell is going on around me? And the answer is a lot. A lot is happening for once.
Yeah. Oh, shoot. Talia, can I interrupt you for a second? I just saw that my recorder didn't start. Fuck.
Oh. That's okay. I do have it recorded. I am recording it on the Skype call. But yeah, if you could just start it now, that'd be great. Yeah, sometimes the voice recorder can honestly be a little tricky, the app.
Got it.
And a little janky. Sorry, Windows.
Yeah.
Oh, no. Don't worry at all. We still have the Skype sound. You'll just like suddenly start sounding mysteriously way better like halfway through the episode. Yeah. So how would you, describe sort of what goes down in this chapter?
Yeah. I was just so excited that I got a chapter with actual action in it. Like, I feel like I won the lottery. This is so cool. I mean, you know, racist opening aside, but like, it was also, a fascinatingly difficult to follow action sequence. I had to reread it a few times to figure out everything that was happening, and particularly because I didn't know that King Post, you know, is Flask and things like that, that I'm sure you already knew because you've been reading this for a while. But it seems to me like it's supposed to be Ishmael's, like, you know, first experience of his exposure to like actually taking a boat out into what I assume is a pod of whales, because it sounds like there are several creating wakes. And there are four, I guess five boats, right, including Ahab's, that leave the Pequod to go hunt the whales. And then it's just the whole process of communicating to the others, who are all puzzled by these five new arrivals who are in Ahab's boat. And then it turns into like a kind of disquisition on the leadership style of each one of the men in charge of each of the boats, which I found totally fascinating and like hilariously implausible, right? As a first person account, like the idea that he could hear what was happening on all of these ships at once is comically impossible, in a way that I really enjoyed.
Oh yeah. It's very silly.
Yeah. But it's so fun to hear their styles and the insanity and incantatory quality of Stubbs is this like, you know, way of cheering his guys on and, you know, Starbucks, you know, own, I guess, brand of insanity, which we find out in the subsequent chapter is just more or less how things are done. In any event, it's a really scary chapter and it's action packed and it also has multiple approaches to the problem of leadership. And I think we're going to like hopefully talk about like the terrifying beauty of the actual moment when the squall starts and when they lose sight of the Pequod and are basically seem to be lost at sea for a second. But it was great. I really enjoyed it.
That was a very eloquent summary. I really liked that. I mean, yeah, there's just a ton going on emotionally, physically. And again, this is our first, like, we've heard so much about whaling. We've heard this whole disquisition about whales. You know, we've heard everything. And then this is our first encounter with, like, the actual practice of it.
Yeah.
And something I've been thinking about for a long time, you know, now, because I started this podcast back in January, is just how terrifying whaling is. And definitely, like, especially was in this period. Like, they're going out in these really small boats, going after these mammoths of the sea.
Yeah.
You know, and then, of course, the weather. First of all, the sea itself is immense and terrifying. And also, but, like, more so when you're pursued. I mean, I don't know. There was this crazy video that I got tagged in a million times because the brand is strong, of like this humpback whale breaching in, I guess it was like off the coast of California. And like, there was a kayaker
Yeah, I saw that.
And like, the whale almost swallowed the dude. Like, that's what they're dealing with here, is like these absolute giant, like, monstrous creatures. Not, I mean, I don't think whales are monstrous. I think they're wonderful, but they're, I'm not sure I would want to be going out in like a little boat to try and contend with them, even if the weather was great.
Terrifying. Totally terrifying. Yeah.
Yeah. And so they have to whip themselves into this mania in order to basically override the natural human instinct to not do that.
I like that.
And so we see this mania in like iterated in a couple of different ways. So Ishmael's with Queequeg in Starbuck's boat. Starbuck's the first mate, and as we have heard repeatedly and is like reiterated in the next chapter, is sort of the most practical and sensible of them all, and also the most skeptical of the sort of white whale quest of everyone. Or at least the one most openly willing to voice that.
Okay.
But yeah, I thought we could, I love to read out loud from this book, and this might be a little unfair of me because it's an absolute bananas paragraph, but I'm wondering if you could give us your best and most dramatic reading of Stubbs' exhortation to his crew.
Oh my God, that's such a privilege. Wow. Oh, okay, let me see if I can find it.
It starts, "Pull, pull, my fine heart's alive." So this is like they're finally sitting off. They've left the Pequod and they're getting into these whale boats, and Stubb is talking to his crew.
Okay. "Pull, pull, my fine heart's alive. Pull, my children, pull, my little ones." Drawlingly and soothingly sighed Stubb to his crew, some of whom still showed signs of uneasiness. "Why don't you break your backbones, my boys? What is it you stare at? Those chaps in yonder boat? Tut! There are only five more hands come to help us. Never mind from where, the more the merrier. Pull, then, do pull. Never mind the brimstone devils are good fellows enough. So, so, there you are now. That's the stroke for 1,000 pounds. That's the stroke to sweep the stakes. Hurrah for the gold cup of sperm oil, my heroes. Three cheers, men, and all hearts alive. Easy, easy. Don't be in a hurry. Don't be in a hurry. Why don't you snap your oars, you rascals? Bite something, you dogs. So, so then. Softly, softly. That's it, that's it. Long and strong. Give way there, give way. The devil fetch you, you ragamuffin rapscallions. You're all asleep. Stop snoring, you sleepers, and pull. Pull, will ya? Pull, can't ya? Pull, won't ya? Why, in the name of gudgeons and ginger cakes, don't you pull? Pull and break something. Pull and start your eyes out. Here. Whipping out the sharp knife from his girdle. Every mother's son of you draw his knife and pull with the blade between his teeth. That's it. That's it. Now you do something. That looks like it, my steel bits. Start her. Start her, my silver spoons. Start her, marling spikes.
Amazing. It's and Ishmael then calls it an exordium, which I had never even heard of.
But so good. Yeah, it's like this crazy exhortation of totally contradictory things, right?
Yeah, it's like, and also drawlingly and soothingly sighing, which I think you did a very good job of kind of conveying how hypnotic this is.
Yeah, I just like the hard and soft, right? Like the crack your bones and now soft, soft, you snoring sleeper. It's just like every emotion wrapped into a kind of weird croon.
I know. It's very like demented Shakespeare. And I think Melville like fairly often hits this register of just like incredibly florid and dramatic, but also just like wild, like buck wild. The man is a maniac with his prose, and it's kind of magnificent sometimes.
And very funny.
Yeah. Like, why in the name of gudgeons and ginger cakes don't you pull?
Yeah.
And, yeah. Which I would like to, like, if I had the presence of mind, I would adopt that as like a regular thing that I said. Like, why in the name of gudgeons and ginger cakes don't you pull? So that's Stubbs' exhortation to his crew.
Yeah.
Mr. Starbuck.
Wait, can we say one more thing about Stubb?
Oh, yeah, please.
I just like that Stubb, the way that he's described at the end of the exordium to his crew paragraph, it says, then again, Stubb was one of those odd sorts of humorists whose jollity is sometimes so curiously ambiguous as to put all inferiors on their guard in the matter of obeying them. Stubb is like funny and terrifying, and I love that description. Okay, I'm sorry, Starbuck now.
Oh, also, it's kind of like you always have to laugh at your boss's jokes, even when you're not sure they're jokes.
There will be a smooth transition to a second Trump administration.
And so it's nice that workplace dynamic has redounded across time and space.
Wow. Okay, that's a lot less charming. I'm turning on Stubb now. Whew. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, but like, on the other hand, I feel like if like you're more prone to an exordium of any sort if you're like leading people into mortal danger, I guess, which is not really the case of like your, you know, Michael Scott kind of figure.
Or Paula White praying for Trump.
Oh, yeah. Oh. I hear the sound of an abundance of rain. Thankfully, she did not hear the sound of victory. I loved all the like trap remixes of that monologue. They've all been amazing, and I will listen to them all.
I haven't seen them. Okay, I'll look for those.
I would kind of listen to a trap remix of this monologue as well.
Thank you. All hearts alive. That's the strokes to sweep the stakes. Never mind the brimstone devils are good fellows enough. So, so, there you are now. Why don't you break your backbones, my boys? Long and strong, give way there, give way. Cut. Stop.
Yeah, so Starbuck has kind of a different style. He's a lot more... So, oh yeah, Stubb asks what he thinks of those yellow boys, meaning Ahab's mysterious new crew. And he replies, "Smuggled on board somehow before the ship sailed. Strong, strong boys," in a whisper to his crew, then speaking out loud again. "A sad business, Mr. Stubb. Seethe her, my lads. But never mind, Mr. Stubb, all for the best. Let all your crew pull strong, come what will. Spring, my men, spring! There's hogheads of sperm ahead, Mr. Stubb, and that's what he came for. Pull, my boys. Sperm, sperm's the play! This, at least, is duty. Duty and profit, hand in hand." Yeah, we have the...
It sounds so much like a Ben Franklin thing, and it's just so the opposite of, like, a penny saved is a penny earned. This is like a gambler's way of life. It's the opposite, but I love that it's described as at least as duty, duty and profit.
Yeah, well, it's duty compared to, like, the quixotic quest for the white whale. Instead, they're on a quixotic quest for every whale. But yeah, we have we're finally mentioning sperm more, so that's good.
That's very good.
The gold cup of sperm oil, sperm's the play. That's what he said. Sorry. I was just like, I have an inner 12-year-old boy that's just like laughing every time they say the word sperm, which makes me a kind of a tiresome host for this literary podcast, but come on.
No, me too. I actually went and reread a couple of Melville's letters to Hawthorne and like his dedication to, anyway, like it's just so beyond
homoerotic. Yeah.
Anyway, it's just delightfully, it's homoerotic is like
the least you can say. Yeah,
it's like calling porn a rom-com or something. Like,
oh yeah, yeah. Anyway. No, it's mm-hmm. And then we come across our third commander, Flask. AKA King Post is like his gangster name, I guess.
And he's very tiny.
Yeah, he's really small. And he's also just going batshit crazy. Like he's, you know, I mean, we have Stubb's exordium is like pretty wild. And Starbuck is like saying, "Seethe my lads," and stuff. But Flask asks Dagu, his harpooner, who is an African man, as we are reminded at great, and again, like deeply exoticizing, bizarre length. Flask asks Dagu to stand on his shoulders. So Flask is standing on Dagu's shoulders.
And on his broad back, flaxen-haired Flask seemed a snowflake. The bearer looked nobler than the rider, as if that's surprising, but anyway.
Yeah. I mean... Though truly vivacious, tumultuous, ostentatious little Flask would now and then stamp with impatience, but not one added heave did he thereby give to the negro's lordly chest. I'm sorry to use that word. I think it was not pejorative at the time. So have I seen passion and vanity stamping the living magnanimous earth, but the earth did not alter her tides and her seasons for that. So I guess he's saying kind of, okay, Flask, stamp all you like, but you're not going to have an effect on, like, the ocean.
Yeah.
And then, so now we get to the business of, oh, and so Flask is, like, basically just having a heck of a time, just throwing his hat around, having a tantrum, standing on someone's shoulders. His style of leadership is just going buck wild. But then we have this, like, to me, incredibly beautiful and evocative description of actual whaling happening and how they spot the whales. So
can I, before we do that, can I just ask you a question since you've been working your way through this whole time?
Yeah.
How excited are you about the fact that you're finally about to see a whale? Like, what is this like for you?
Well, it's kind of like, I mean, the book is such a tease, right? Like, I mean, yeah. We are seeing a whale, but like the titular whale does not crop up for a long time yet. And so I am pretty amped. It's cool to see the whaling in practice. And we've actually already had, like, a full disquisition on, like, each of their leadership styles before. Now we're just seeing it in action. But it is really cool to see whaling happening. And one of the things that made me love this book so much was just its descriptions of the sea and, like, danger on the sea. And I think Belleville does a really beautiful job exposing just, or like talking about just how much peril is involved and how much beauty at the same time. And so that's really exciting for me. Not that I minded the like 40 odd chapters of kind of puttering, but,
no,
still puttering.
Well, yeah, it's like watching the new Twin Peaks and you're just waiting forever for like, you know, the agent to come back. I'm blanking on his name. You know, you're just like very excited when it happens.
Yeah. Or like when Kira and Odo finally kiss in Deep Space Nine. I've been waiting for that for seasons. and then they're such a sweet couple. That's, yeah. Anyway, I've become a Trekkie in quarantine.
I've noticed. I think it's great.
So now we have to a landsman. No whale nor any sign of a herring would have been visible at that moment. Nothing but a troubled bit of greenish white water and thin scattered puffs of vapor hovering over it and suffusingly blowing off to leeward like the confused scud from white rolling billows. The air around suddenly vibrated and tingled, as it were, like the air over intensely heated plates of iron. Beneath this atmospheric waving and curling, and partially beneath a thin layer of water, also, the whales were swimming, seen in advance of all the other indications. The puffs of vapor they spouted seemed their forerunning couriers and detached flying outriders. All four boats were now in keen pursuit of that one spot of troubled water and air, but it bade fair to outstrip them. It flew on and on, as a mass of interblending bubbles borne down a rapid stream from the hills. So that's like we're seeing the whales. And I wonder if you could read Flask's monologue here. I'm just making you read the most dramatic bits.
The little king post? How different the loud little king post?
Yeah.
Okay. Sing out and say something, my hearties. Roar and pull my thunderbolts. Beach me on their black backs, boys. Only do that for me and I'll sign over to you my Martha's Vineyard plantation, boys, including wife and children, boys. Lay me on. Oh, Lord, Lord, but I shall go stark, staring mad. See that white water. And so, shouting, he pulled his hat from his head and stamped up and down on it. Then, picking it up, flirted it far off upon the sea, and finally fell to rearing and plunging in the boat stern like a crazed colt from the prairie.
Which is amazing. He's like, take my wife, please, but get me a whale first. And I think at this point he's probably not on Dagny's shoulder anymore.
I mean, if he's stamping up and down on his hat, I feel like it logistically there would be issues with remaining atop.
Yeah. And then Stubb is saying, and then I'll read Stubb's little monologue. Look at that chap now, philosophically drawled Stubb, who with his unlighted short pipe mechanically retained between his teeth, at a short distance followed after. He's got fits, that Flask has. Fits? Yes, give him fits. That's the very word. Pitch fits into him. Merrily, merrily, heart's alive. Pudding for supper, you know. Mary's the word. Pull, babes. Pull, sucklings. Pull all. But what the devil are you hurrying about? Softly, softly, and steadily, my men. Only pull, and keep pull, pulling, nothing more. Crack all your backbones and bite your knives into you. That's all. Take it easy. Why don't you take it easy, I say, and burst all your livers and lungs.
I feel like this speech is like being on Twitter. Really, you're getting imperatives to do a ton of totally contradictory things, and every one of your reactions is wrong.
Right. It's like just chill out.
Crack all your backbones and bite your knives into. Take it easy. why don't you take it easy? Burst your livers and lungs.
Right? And also calling, like, I feel like it's a little inappropriate to call your subordinates sucklings, but, you know, it was a different time.
It sure was.
Little babes. Little sucklings.
But, I mean, there's a lot of weirdly maternal tenderness in some of these addresses, and Stubbs especially, like, I don't know what to make of that, right? But, like, silver spoons, I don't know. There's a nursery rhyminess, I feel like, to Stubbs' way that seems distinct from the others. But
Yeah. He's drawling philosophically. That's what he does. And then as to Ahab and his mysterious crew, we hear... what it was that inscrutable Ahab said to that tiger yellow crew of his, these were words best omitted here, for you live under the blessed light of the evangelical land. Only the infidel sharks in the audacious seas may give ear to such words when, with tornado brow and eyes of red murder and foam-glued lips, Ahab leaped after his prey. So it's like, Flask might be going nuts, but Ahab's like... rabies kind of style and clearly cursing up the storm. And then I'm going to read one more paragraph and then we can kind of summarize a bit more what happens. But I just really love this paragraph. I think it's beautiful. It was a sight full of wonder, quick wonder and awe. The vast swells of the omnipotent sea, the surging hollow roar they made as they rolled along the eight gunwales like gigantic bowls in a boundless bowling green. The brief suspended agony of the boat as it would tip for an instant on the knife-like edge of the sharper waves that almost seemed threatening to cut it in two. The sudden profound dip in the watery glens and hollows, the keen spurnings and goadings to gain the top of the opposite hill, the headlong, sled-like slide down its other side, all these with the cries of the headsmen and harpooners and the shuddering gasps of the oarsmen with the wondrous sight of the ivory Pequod bearing down upon her boats with outstretched sails like a wild hen after her screaming brood. All this was thrilling. Not the raw recruit marching from the bosom of his wife into the fever heat of his first battle. Not the dead man's ghost encountering the first unknown phantom in the other world. Neither of these can feel stranger and stronger emotions than the man does, who for the first time finds himself pulling into the charmed, churned circle of the hunted sperm whale. I mean, that's just beautiful writing.
It's just like, it's beautiful and it's like a hurricane of metaphors. So you're just, by the end, you're just exhausted from even trying to track what they're doing. It's an amazing... amazing thing.
It's a sled, it's a hen, it's a knife.
And also a man going into battle, and also steel. I love how much heat comes up in the descriptions of the water, because it just seems so contradictory, but like, you know, I don't know, they're like jets of vapor. Sometimes the water just acts like volcanic in ways that are, I feel so cold reading a lot of this chapter and the subsequent one, like how freezing they must have been, that I'm like, I just kept being surprised by like the evocations of like insane heat.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, this is a heat of anger and anxiety and passion that, but also like the cold, cold ocean around. But yeah, jets of vapor sounds very, like sounds very like hot. I guess jets of vapor coming out of a whale would be hot, but yeah.
Would they? Oh, that's interesting. Cause they say like a gush of scalding vapor shot up nearby. Scalding. So maybe is it hot?
I mean, maybe not. That's, I don't know, but like it is coming out of a warm living body.
Right.
Yeah. So then,
oh yeah. And then there's like the crazy, like you have the gush of scalding vapor shot up nearby. Something rolled and tumbled like an earthquake beneath us. This is when the whale is under them. And the whole crew were half suffocated as they were tossed helter skelter into the white curdling cream of the squall. My God. It's just a lot of metaphors and they're very evocative together.
Yeah. So the moment a little bit earlier when basically Queequeg stands up, he's ready to harpoon the whale. Though not one of the oarsmen was then facing the life and death peril so close to them ahead, yet with their eyes on the intense countenance of the mate in the stern of the boat, they knew that the imminent instant had come. They heard, too, an enormous wallowing sound, as of 50 elephants stirring in their litter. Meanwhile, the boat was still booming through the mists, the waves curling and hissing around us like the erected crests of enraged serpents. So there's like two more metaphors. 50 elephants. There's elephants and serpents and cream and sperm.
It's just everything.
There's just squall, whale, and harpoon. It all blended together, and the whale, really grazed by the iron, escaped. So they get like basically bumped by this whale, and the whale escapes, just grazed by the harpoon, and they're kind of half swamped, sinking up to their knees in the sea, water covering every rib and plank, so that to our downward gazing eyes, the suspended craft seemed a coral boat grown up to us from the bottom of the ocean. It's really dramatic.
Aaron was watching Titanic today and was talking about how incredibly harrowing the last half was. He was very bored by the first half, but he was talking about how intense it was. And I was thinking about that as I was reading this, just like when the boat starts taking on water is just an existentially terrifying scene. And it's weird that this works out to me.
Yeah.
I'm glad it does, but I'm surprised.
Yeah. I mean, I keep saying that I'm not going to read out loud anymore and then lying because I just really like everything about. Yeah, the wind increased to a howl. The waves dashed their bucklers together. The whole squall roared, forked, and crackled around us like a white fire upon the prairie, in which unconsumed we were burning, immortal in these jaws of death. And they try to hail the other boats, as well roar to the live coals down the chimney of a flaming furnace as hail those boats in that storm. And they're kind of screwed. And then Starbuck contrives to light a lantern and stretches it on a pole as the standard bearer of this forlorn hope. And then they kind of... There then he sat, holding up that imbecile candle in the heart of that almighty forlornness. There then he sat, the sign and symbol of a man without faith, hopelessly holding up hope in the midst of despair.
It's very bleak.
Yeah, and terrifying. I mean, being on a tiny little whaleboat, I mean, these are small compared to a ship. In the middle of a storm, like, your comrades have abandoned you. All your only hope is in this lantern. I mean, that is dark.
Do you think that did this boat actually logistically survive this?
I think it could.
Because it seems to me like they swam back onto the boat.
So,
but I wasn't totally clear.
Yeah, basically the Pequod, what happens then is like the Pequod finds them by accident. I mean, the Pequod's kind of like hanging around. They like thinks they're dead, but is like, okay, we'll check it out. And then the sound came nearer and nearer, and then like the ship loomed into view, bearing right down upon us, and they all leap into the sea because the ship, the Pequod, runs over their whale boat. That's what happened.
Okay.
Yeah.
I missed that.
And then
wow.
The other boats were fine and like survived. They'd cut loose. They cut loose from their whales and they were fine, but like Starbuck was very stubborn and like wouldn't let go of his whale. And that's why they capsized. Or like didn't really right. capsize, like were basically half sunk and shivering. Mm-hmm. And then so they all had jumped into the sea and then were rescued, taken up and landed safely on board. The ship had given us up, but it was still cruising. If haply it might light upon some token of our perishing, an oar or a lance pole. was like, the Pequod was thought they were all dead, but wanted to maybe salvage something, and it turns out that they had survived against.
I have to say, I find that like a really hilarious ending to this like very harrowing chapter. It's just like, if haply it might light upon some token of our perishing, an oar or a lance bowl. But like, it doesn't say, and it did, and we're like, it's a very anticlimactic sort of deflating final line.
Yeah, especially for such a dramatic chapter. And especially because like Melville's really good at chapter endings and like usually ends very dramatically and like cliffhanger-ishly. And like we've had these crazy lines like immortal in the midst, in the jaws of death and whatnot. Like that's the way it ends. But I guess, I mean, I think the overall point you come away with is that like, and this is Ishmael's like first time ever doing the wailing thing. And he's like, holy crap. We almost died, and like it was, and then, but that's just the business of it. Like, fatality is almost expected.
Yeah, I mean, I love that the next chapter is basically him like going around to everyone saying, like, hey, so that was crazy, right? And they're all like, no, that's just normal.
Buddy, what did you think you signed up for? A shift at Arby's? Like, come on now. Yeah, so let's talk about chapter 49, the hyena. I don't know why it's called the hyena. I read it. I don't know why it's called the hyena.
I don't know that either. Okay, I was hoping you did. Okay.
I mean, I guess.
I have the hyena app.
Like, I don't think there's a hyena in it.
There isn't. I checked.
Okay. I mean, yeah. But would you mind reading the first paragraph of this chapter? Because I think it's great.
There are certain queer times and occasions in this strange mixed affair we call life, when a man takes his whole universe for a vast practical joke, though the wit thereof he but dimly discerns, and more than six suspects that the joke is at nobody's expense but his own. However, nothing dispirits, and nothing seems worthwhile disputing. He bolts down all events, all creeds and beliefs and persuasions, all hard things visible and invisible, never mind how knobby. As an ostrich of potent digestion gobbles down bullets and gunflints. And as for small difficulties and worryings, prospects of sudden disaster, peril of life and limb, all these, and death itself, seem to him only sly, good-natured hits and jolly punches in the side bestowed by the unseen and uncountable old joker. That odd sort of wayward mood I'm speaking of comes over a man only in some time of extreme tribulation. It comes in the very midst of his earnestness, so that what just before might have seemed to him a thing most momentous now seems but a part of the general joke. There is nothing like the perils of wailing to breed this free and easy sort of genial desperado philosophy. And with it, I now regarded this whole voyage of the Pequod and the great white whale, its object.
I love this paragraph. I love this description of like what perennial danger and stress and kind of encounters with kind of fate does to a person, and it just makes you believe everything and not care and think that the universe is a joke at your expense. And I feel like, although it is very different from, again, the commercial whaling industry, I think a lot of us have felt over the last 3 years, and particularly over the last year, of kind of plague, like living through a disastrously managed national plague and like constantly confronted with the thought of our own mortality. A lot of us have encountered the fact that like many people are more susceptible to many dubious beliefs. A lot of us have encountered kind of this, it's the end of the world, so fuck it kind of sentiment. I mean, I think there's a lot that kind of rings true here, even in 2020. I don't know if you had that same feeling.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was a really interesting, like, little ode to Black humor, right? And, like, and I think partly what's interesting about it, too, is, like, compared to when you think back to the chapter we just finished, right, which opens with him, like, seeing the phantoms racistly and then culminates in this, you know, very anticlimactic thing about oars that might have signaled his doom, with the giant, incredible, you know, hurricane of metaphors in between. Like, it's so interesting that it would switch to humor, right? And like, as a thing to be unpacked. But then, I mean, am I wrong that he it's not actually funny?
Well,
the rest of it.
Yeah, I mean, or you mean the book, like.
The chapter.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it seems like it's kind of, I'm expecting it to be like a treatment of like the humor of what has just happened. And I guess the humor is that like he asks three people and they all, you know, tell him that, yes, this is normal. And so the joke is at his expense. Okay. Is that what you think it is?
Yeah. I think also like Melville is surprisingly funny a lot of times. Like the book is very serious, but it also just like will randomly throw in jokes. And I think the joke here is on Ishmael. Yeah. That he's like, was that normal? What we just did? And like, are you telling me that like Starbuck, the guy who I just like was in his boat as like during a storm, he went after a whale and like wouldn't let it go.
He's like submitting a form to HR complaining that this was clearly like an OSHA violation, right?
Yeah. And he's like, are you telling me this guy's like the practical one? This is the one that you've been telling me like, oh, he's so cautious for a whaleman. Oh, like that's how crazy this whole business is. Like, it's like Ishmael finally like letting it sink in.
Because Stubbs says like, certain, I've lowered for whales from a leaking ship in a gale off Cape Horn, says Stubbs. So, yeah.
It's like, we're all mad here. So I also just to go back for a second, and because you've drawn my attention to like Melville's surfeit of metaphors, the metaphor of like someone believing all events, creeds, and beliefs and persuasions, like believing anything, just like an ostrich of potent digestion can eat bullets and gunflints.
I know, it's so weird.
Like, that's your first, that's the first metaphor that came to mind, buddy? How many omnivorous ostriches have you encountered that's your first thought?
Especially in a chapter titled The Hyena, when hyenas like would probably have something to offer to this particular image.
Yeah, or like a goat.
Yeah.
Just absolute madness in the metaphor reign. So Ishmael is basically going around getting everybody. Is it an unalterable law in this fishery, Mr. Flask, for an oarsman to break his own back, pulling himself back foremost into death's jaws? And Flask's like, yeah. Like, of course you would go at a whale backwards. Like, you wouldn't go face forward to it. Otherwise, it would squint at you. I don't know. No one really gives him very satisfactory answers, but Ishmael goes and makes his will after this journey.
Yeah, and we get the nice little Lazarus comparison.
Not the first time, Lazarus.
And he feels, and having like talked about the Ahab's five men as phantoms, now he's like a quiet ghost with a clean conscience sitting inside the bars of a snug family vault.
Yeah, I love that. We've also had like, there are a lot of ghost metaphors in these two chapters. Like, Ishmael compares himself to a ghost just entering the underworld for the first time and like meeting other ghosts. And it's like, you know what's weirder than that? Being a whaler. And so he asks, basically these questions three of like, is this normal? Is that normal? And everyone's like, yeah, Ishmael, it's normal. Like, obviously you signed up for like the most harrowing profession possible for like very terrible money, and like I can't believe you didn't know that. And so Ishmael's like, I'm gonna make my will. By the way, sailors love making their wills, apparently.
I know, it's a fun hobby. Okay, can I ask you a question about Ishmael since you've been spending time with him?
Oh yeah.
Okay, so like, is he I know that he's telling all of this in retrospect, right? Like, we start with Call Me Ishmael. So, like, we know that it's in hindsight. But, like, are you seeing him change like having watched him finally go through this, are you noticing, like, are there differences in the narration or in the point of view or anything? Like,
well, I mean, this is a very direct, like, often, like, the previous 30 chapters or whatever, Ishmael's been very dreamy, and he describes himself as sort of dreamy. Like, a lot of what he does is kind of, when it's his turn to take his watch in the crow's nest, he basically just, like, dozes off and thinks about stuff and almost falls off the rigging because he's daydreaming so hard. And, like, this seems to have snapped him pretty harshly into reality a time.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think we've seen the full change this wreaks on him yet. And, like, that will definitely come to fruition. But I think this moment where he decides to make his will, I think is a pivotal moment for him where he's, like, really recognizing the peril of his situation. You know, he's finally considering in what a devil's chase I was implicated, touching the white whale. And then he asks Queequeg to be his lawyer, which I think is funny.
Yeah. Lawyer, executor, and legatee.
Lover, lawyer, harpooner. Queequeg is a man of many talents. Would you mind reading the last two pieces of this?
Oh, sure. The last two graphs.
It may seem strange. Yeah, sure. It may seem strange to the end.
It may seem strange that of all men, sailors should be tinkering at their last wills and testaments, but there are no people in the world more fond of that diversion. This was the fourth time in my nautical life that I had done the same thing. After the ceremony was concluded upon the present occasion, I felt all the easier. A stone was rolled away from my heart. Besides, all the days I should now live would be as good as the days that Lazarus lived after his resurrection. A supplementary clean gain of so many months or weeks as the case may be. I survived myself. My death and burial were locked up in my chest. I looked round me tranquilly and contentedly like a quiet ghost with a clean conscience sitting inside the bars of a snug family vault. Now then, thought I, unconsciously rolling up the sleeves of my frock. Here goes for a cool, collected dive at death and destruction, and the devil fetch the hindmost.
See, now that is like a hell of a banger of a chapter.
Yes, that's
ender,
a really good kicker.
Unlike
yeah.
the previous one. And I think this is a very famous line.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. Now for a clean, cool dive at death and destruction. Devil fetch the hindmost. That's just a baller attitude. Like, and it very much diverges from the Ishmael we've seen, who is sort of, even from the very first, kind of goes to sea because he doesn't want to kill himself. So it's like the death drive is there mm-hmm. from the start, but he definitely seems hardened by his brush with mortality here, and like in such a spectacular fashion too, like finally encountering a whale, the squall, the almost sinking. And he's like, all right, you know what? I'm living on borrowed time now. I should have died. It's clearly like wacko that I survived and anyway. And so everything else from here is just kind of a bonus. I've made my will. I'm a dead man walking or sailing. And fuck it, let's do this. it's very macho.
Yeah, a stone was rolled away from my
heart.
It's
very macho. Yeah. He describes his feeling as that of a desperado. And he's sort of acting that way now. After kind of basically describing himself as kind of a dreamy nerd beforehand. He's basically dirty Harry over here. Or whatever the whaling equivalent of that would be. So we're seeing the toll this business takes on even the most distracted and philosophical of sailors.
Oh, I love that. You know, like I hadn't actually read that as a desperado mood. Like I was taking the like clean conscience and quiet ghost in a snug family vault seriously as like, but you're right. Like the end is obviously a preparation for action after signing a will. It's interesting to think, right, that writing it down is a way of like accepting the fact of your own death, which I guess is what the novel is too, right? If Ishmael is the narrator, like writing a will is a way of confronting the fact that you're not going to exist.
Yeah.
Oh, Ishmael.
I know. I kind of want to give him a hug. A weird, I'm sure he's very smelly kind of a hug. I kind of want to give them all a hug. I just like love everyone on this ship.
Really?
Yeah. I feel very emotionally attached to them at this point. Even Ahab. Just because he's so traumatized and like that's so clearly driving everything he's doing. But yeah. So this is Ishmael going plump on a flying whale with your sail set in a foggy squall. And being like, oh, this is me. Like cue playing the song Desperado. Desperado. Yeah, the genial desperado philosophy, which really goes against basically the prior portrayal of him as quite neurotic. But yeah, he's like, wow. I'm so dead, I might as well just be a ghost in a family vault. That's how I interpret that line.
Okay.
Not to poop on your interpretation. I think both can coexist. Like he both feels sort of cozy and snug after making his will and being like, well, I tied that up. But then also I was like,
well, I mean, I think it's of a piece, like he's sort of obeying Stubbs's insane directions, right? Which are like, break your back and now take it soft. You know, the kind of alternation between like work as hard as you possibly can and also take it easy. Like that mentality, I guess, is what you need to make it as a whaler. And he's doing it here naturally, like just on his own.
Yeah. Like,
right.
Take your knife between your teeth, bust your liver, but chill, but in a chill way. So Lily, thank you so much for like really diving deep into this with me.
Thank you.
What a delight. And let me ask you the question I've asked every guest on every episode of this podcast. What would you bring on a whaling journey? 3 years around the Cape of Horn, but you can bring anything from any time period.
Is there a way to charge things?
Like, do they have Apple Pay on the sea?
No, like electricity.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I guess assume you have, I don't know, a magic charger.
Okay. If I have a magic charger, I think I'm bringing... I'm torn between an electric blanket and a DSL camera. Okay, camera.
You can bring both. I think an electric blanket and a really good camera is like a really good answer. I don't think anyone's answered electric blanket before, but that makes so much sense.
It's very cold on these boats. It's just very cold. I can't stop thinking about it.
And they were so chilly and scared in chapter 48. That made me really sad. Yeah, well, that's a great answer. And Lily, thank you so much for doing this and really delving into this whimsical endeavor of getting through Moby Dick with me.
Thank you.
Do you have anything? Do you have anything you'd like to plug to our listeners, or where can they find you?
Oh, I mean, I'm on Twitter. Melissa Stomer is my handle, but there's no need. But thank you for chatting with me. What?
Do you know I thought you were named Millicent Summer for a really long time?
Oh, yeah. No, a lot of people think that, and I kind of encourage it because it makes things confusing. You have to work a little bit harder to figure out what I am, and I'm fine with that.
I looked it up once, but what is Millicent Summer? What is the story behind that?
Oh, they're the names of two blogs I used to have combined. One was a dissertation blog and one was a blog I wrote with a friend. And so when I needed to come up with a handle, I just mashed their names together.
What did you write your dissertation about?
It's called Excremental Virtue. And it's about eating and reading in early modern England and like the way that communion and and theories of what reading did were related.
I love that.
And how digestion is the key term in both of them, and the place where will and grace combine.
Oh my God, I might have to have you on for the How to Eat a Whale chapter, given that you've written so much about eating. I love that. Okay, well, so our pluggables, you can find the podcast at Moby Dick Energy on Twitter. We have a merch store, MobyDickEnergy.threadless.com, and a Patreon. That's just me, Patreon.com/Talia Lavin, bringing you this lo-fi Moby Dick podcast for free. And to our listeners, remember, break your backbones, take it easy. The devil fetch you, your ragamuffin rapscallions, you're all asleep. Stop snoring and pull. Pull. Why in the name of gudgeons and ginger cakes don't you pull? Chill out. It's okay. Don't worry, my silver spoons. I love you, my marling spikes. And talk to you next week.
Moby Dick Energy. Big Moby Dick Energy.
I want that Moby Dick. I want that energy. I want that Moby Dick Energy. Big Moby Dick Energy. I want that MDE. That Moby Dick Energy. I want that Moby Dick Energy. Big Moby Dick Energy.
Just think of the language of it. The language of it is the people shall be secure. Let's see now. This is my wife calling, I think. Hello, dear.
My name is Bob. I'm talking. And I'm looking for my wife. She's been gone 2 days. She left a voice message about not being able to vote. And because she was disappeared, I was too unable to vote. And I'm calling this hotline to report that the root of this is apparently suspect, 6'4", dressing all black, Antifa, possibly I've heard with the girth of a soup can, and chiseled cheekbones, green eyes, that you could like walk into like a lush forest, and lovely complexion and healthy milky skin. Just amazing. And my wife was unable to vote, and now I'm looking for her, and I really miss her, and I don't know if she's with him, and maybe like if they just talked to me, if they just told me that they needed to be together just for one night, I would maybe just observe, and not in a homosexual way, or not like a cuck or anything, but more like, you know, you ever see The Bodyguard? Like Kevin Costner, like protecting Whitney Houston? My wife, you know, my wife doesn't need protection.